there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week, we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us. Welcome to Words to Write By.
Hey, everybody. Oh, my.
Try that again.
Hey, everybody.
Before we get started, we'll do our usual Patreon and process group pitches.
Okay. So, if you go to the website, you will find a really cool poster of a girl writing, and in the background, you will see two cats. If you click on that poster, it will take you to the process group on Meetup. It's free and it's fun, and we meet every other Wednesday. So we hope to see you there.
And it's at 5 p.m. on Wednesdays, Pacific Standard Time, for 1 hour. So,
yep, fun, okay. Fun.
And then the other thing is we have a Patreon site. If you're enjoying these podcasts and you want to hear a little bit more, every podcast or most podcasts, we do a writing exercise and we like to workshop them on the podcast. And we include one on the podcast here and one on our bonus podcast. If you go to Patreon, you can sign up and listen to those podcasts.
Yep. All right, everybody. So this is a momentous occasion.
It has only happened three times before.
Only happened three times before.
We've finished a book.
Another book. Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird. Final chapter. What's it called, Kim?
The Last Class. So this is definitely a wrap-up chapter. I wasn't expecting to get anything really informative here, although she basically tries to summarize the whole book. And I don't think the other books we've read have had a last chapter. They've just kind of petered out.
Yeah, they just kind of end.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bickham had a whole bunch of, like, kind of putting it all together for a large book, but it was a little bit much.
Yeah, he had, like, a chapter. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, a plot outline for a page-turner. It was quite heavy.
But Bradbury's book that was kind of a collection of essays didn't have much towards the end, I don't remember.
No. What I found fascinating in this last chapter is she really did capture the voice, that melancholy voice of knowing this is the last class of a group of students that you liked.
Yes, of a good class.
Yes, you had a really good class and you feel sad that it's, you're glad that it's over because you want to go back to your life, but you're going to miss everybody.
Yeah, you know? You're going to miss that routine.
And all the people there, you know, you recognize all those students. Some of them were really cool students. You know, you hope you see them again, but you know there's a good chance you won't. And so she really did a good job of capturing that voice and that feeling in this chapter. And as a teacher, I felt it. I was like, yeah, I've been there.
Actually, I was going to bring this up later, but I think this is a good place to bring it up. I was thinking about how with these different writing craft books have been directed at different sorts of people, different sorts of writers. I was listing it off, and basically Gardner was writing for a MFA student or a university student taking creative writing classes.
The young writer.
Probably male. white. With dreams of writing for the New Yorker and writing these best-selling, momentous texts.
Right, using mythology and folklore as a background. You know, being some kind of literary expert.
Yes. And then Bradbury, I think, was writing largely for his fans or fans of science fiction that knew him.
Right. With gusto.
Yes, and it had a lot of great information in it, but it was also very much aimed for people that wanted to read what Ray Bradbury had to say.
Right. And also just those who wanted to write science fiction, speculative fiction specifically.
Exactly. And it was kind of nice because I've noticed that each of the writers, they have their own like area where they write in, and that's where they pull a lot of their examples from. So Bradbury had a lot more like science fiction examples to bring in. And then we had Bickham. Who do you think he was writing for?
I think he was writing for the practical writer. You know, that person could have been middle-aged or whatever, and they want to write a novel, and they want to write a commercial novel, and they're not messing around.
And that was also part of a Reader's Digest series?
Yes. In fact, I own that whole series, and all of those books are fantastic. You can't really do all of them on this podcast because that would be really weird, but I would suggest the whole series. You can get them for pennies on eBay.
Yes. And then that brings us to Lamont. And I have an idea who Lamont was writing for.
Do you? Okay.
I said she was writing to older individuals who had always wanted to be a writer, but had done different things in their lives, and they were non-traditional. And she was kind of writing this book and writing doing her classes to have them open up and reach out to these people.
Yeah. People who maybe are a little bit shy, really very new. I got undergraduate vibes or adult school vibes.
Mm-hmm. Adult students going to school to learn what they didn't realize they needed to learn earlier.
Right. To enrich their lives.
Yeah, definitely.
Also, I would say, so now you could go online and you can find workshops everywhere. Like you can get them on Zoom. We take them and there are lots of them. In Lamont's time, you had to go somewhere physical and you had to go find them. Like, it's not like there's a commercial and there wasn't internet. So, you know.
Well, this was 1994, but there was definitely wasn't video conferencing. And also, I should say that even though this book was published in 1994, she was giving these classes much earlier.
Yes. So say, you know, we go back in a time machine and we go into the past and we're a budding author or somebody who wants to write. Where do you go for a class? Like, for me, I would be like, oh, local community college.
Community colleges or small towns would have organizations that put out, like, classes that people would take.
Right. And then there's also, you know, the colleges open up for older students. Mm-hmm. You know, usually they already have their bachelor's or they're just older and they're just, like, enriching their minds. I remember almost every Shakespeare class I ever took had a group of retired individuals in the corner, and they were all kind of part of a cohort. I don't think they had to pay for the class either. They probably do now. Open courses, I think they're called. Anyway, they weren't quite auditing, but anyway, that's what I thought.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it was. Either she was doing it through community colleges, or they were being set up to come and take this class by Anne Lamont. I think also the people that she was teaching had ambitions to be published, but probably much fewer of them were going to navigate the publishing track as opposed to the people that Gardner was directing his stuff towards. Or even Bickham. I got from Bickham a very working class sort of thing. Like if you were going to get all the way through the Bickham book, you were mining it for techniques.
Right, right.
But I think what I was getting, especially from this last chapter, is that she was preparing her students not to be published, but to keep writing their whole lives, even if they weren't published.
Right.
What I felt she was telling us as readers was our writing, even if we didn't get published, even if nobody other than our critique group knew about it, had the power to change our lives and to change our approach to things. She comments about how, you know, you could stack bricks as a laborer, you could stack bricks as an artisan. And her belief, and this is consistent through a lot of writers I've heard, is that the act of writing down what's happened to you, the act of thinking about it and presenting it, makes you live your life more fully.
Well stated.
And I was thinking I'd also mention a story that I was thinking about as I was listening to this. And this is specifically in response to her comment that, you know, if all your writing ever goes further is for your critique group, that it really does matter. And I wanted to bring up a story of a woman that I knew that passed away very recently. And the thing is, I did not know her hardly at all, except that I had been in some critique groups with her and I knew her writing. And she had presented parts of her memoir there and she was trying to repackage the memoir into like a short story. She'd never been published. because I'd listened to her memoir, I knew about the various illnesses that she had, the various struggles that she had with her family and her marriage and her death of her brother and just like all this stuff that I know personally about her, even though I did not know her as a person at all. It's an interesting thing to think about. You know, when you're in your critique groups, you're reading a piece, you know, even if you throw it away later on and don't like it at all, you are affecting the people that hear that piece.
Nice.
Yeah. So that's what I was thinking about when I was reading this. Do you find that you live more fully when you're writing?
Yes. I feel like when I'm writing, I'm doing the thing I'm supposed to be doing. I'm doing the thing that I've kind of always wanted to do, even though I don't always want to do it. I know that sounds dumb.
No, I think that sounds just about right. Like, I never actually want to sit down and physically write, but
I think about it all the fucking time. Don't you?
It definitely permeates. Like, you see something, it sparks something in your head. And then the story just sort of unfurls, and it's like, is this going to go anywhere, or is it going to get written down?
Right. And then when you get hit flow, it's like being on a drug, you know? You're just like, oh, you're in it, and you're doing it. And you think, how could I ever not want to sit here and do this? And I always think when I get there, I want to put this in a bottle so I could drink it later and get myself there, but it doesn't work that way.
It does not work that way. But reading a book like this, I think, does help you get that way. The sort of focus and encouragement does help get butt in the chair and get writing.
Right. There was some advice I thought was interesting in the end. Like, she knows her time with us and her students is fleeting. It is the last class. And, you know, she can say the last things that they might remember, right? Or remind them of stuff that she thought was most important. And I thought that was interesting, the things that she decided were important to bring up again. For example, exploring and understanding your childhood will give you the ability to empathize. And that understanding and empathy will teach you to write with intelligence and insight and compassion. So she's very much into mine your childhood for stuff. I thought that was interesting. Becoming a writer is about becoming conscious. When you're conscious and writing from a place of insight and simplicity and real caring about the truth, you have the ability to throw the lights on for your reader.
I thought that was a really good one. I underlined that one. I liked the, you must risk placing real emotion at the center of your work. Write straight into the emotional center of things, right towards vulnerability.
Yes.
And I think that's something that is both critical in making a piece meaningful, but also making the act of writing it down meaningful.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I'm writing and I'm kind of aware that I'm posing. I'm faking it. Like, I don't really know what this is. I'm kind of writing around it and it doesn't feel like there's any center. And then other times I know what I'm writing about. As I get deeper and deeper in explaining it, even if it's a scientific idea, I feel good.
Yeah. I'm not sure if this was the book. I think it may have been, but way early on, the early episodes we were doing for our Bird by Bird, I started doing an activity where I used I over and over again because I was writing about my life as things happening to me, but not so much me being a character. And these quotes remind me of the time I was doing that over and over again, like in a list, trying to get myself in my own story.
Mm-hmm.
And like, who was I? I had a hard time figuring out who the heck I even was at that age. And when she says things like, you know, try to write in a directly emotional way instead of being too subtle or oblique, it was like, I get it now. Like, you create distance, especially in a memoir, you create some distance in order to like protect yourself, like emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
And part of coming to the page and being real and authentic is to actually use the I. You don't have to, but use the I or get very close and really think about your feelings and really figure out what they were so that you can reveal them. And that's a scary thing to do. Anyway, she helped me get there. Thank you, Lamont. Yeah. Oh, and one last quote, be afraid of not getting your writing done. Dun, dun.
Sort of like if you put enough of your identity into being a writer, if you're not published, then the act of not writing is negative.
Right. She's a little bit of worry there, poking us with some worry.
And then there was one last thing. She's starting to shoehorn this one in. Like, wait a second, I meant to talk about this thing. Let's put it in the last chapter. The quote is, Ethan Cahan insists that you should never write out of vengeance, while I tell my students that they should always write out of vengeance, as long as they do it nicely. And so I think what she's talking about is, again, writing about vulnerability, writing about stuff that is emotionally important to you. And sometimes what really gets people going, that really gets to the heart of the truth, is something they're angry about and they just got to get it out.
Yep. And it's interesting that she, like you said, shoehorns this topic at the end for the next, like, almost the rest of the book, the next, like, six pages, talks about libel.
Libel.
Which is weird because she's focusing on fiction.
She is, yes. Well, if you're going to write about vengeance, part of the issue is you're writing pretty close to the truth. Libel, just so people know, is a legal term, which is when someone makes or writes false statements that do damage to a person's reputation.
Right.
And there are plenty of people that write fiction that you can tell who they're writing about.
Oh, yes. If you've ever read any Charles Bukowski, he wrote a book called Women. Mm-hmm. And all those ladies existed. And they were pissed.
So one defense against libel is if the statement is true, you're allowed to speak the truth, even if it damages someone's reputation, because if they actually did it. However, I was kind of scanning the internet. They said, well, truth is a proper defense of libel. It does not actually stop people from suing you. So I think here she was talking a little less about someone making false statements and getting sued and having to pay out damages as much as the emotional repercussions of having someone see themselves in your work.
Right. Which for some, that's the revenge.
Yeah, but there are consequences too.
So her trick, which makes sense, what you got to do is if you make a character based on a real person, just make it so that person cannot be identified. That's it.
Right. If you completely describe them as someone different, completely different features, completely different age, completely different relationship to you, you drop it back. So something happened to you when you were 30 and you drop it back to high school. Even though the incident may be very there, it's not like that person can claim that you did damages to them because they don't look like that person that wasn't happening in high school. There's no way that somebody reading the book will say, aha, this is who this person is.
Right. And Lamont has a really great quote. She is the quote master, I would say. Here she says, if you disguise this person carefully so that he cannot be recognized by the physical or professional facts of his life, you can use him in your work. And the best advice I can give you is to give him a teeny little penis so he will be less likely to come forth.
She repeats this one several times.
Oh, yes, this joke comes back.
Which doesn't do much good if you're complaining about a woman, but.
Well, I guess you'd call her Mud Puddle or something. I don't know. It's weird.
I found the idea of writing, of changing the features, or this other idea that's just we make a composite character where you have various features within that single person. Those are really good techniques. I think that in today's age of social media and oversharing, that this technique will not actually stop that person from coming after you.
Oh, right.
This was all written before everyone had iPhones that could put out pictures that were not complimentary or could get back to haunt them. I think we've all become a lot more jaded about these things. And so this bit of advice, I think, has passed its due date.
I think it's important because in the past, if someone wanted to sue for libel, they'd actually have to read the book. Now, someone could sue for libel just by reading, like, spark notes or, like, a summary of the book. Like, oh, I know that author. I wonder if he or she wrote about me. And they probably don't even have to read the whole book. Or it comes out on social media. Like, somebody other says, wonder what this person thought of the book. And then you're like, me? What would I think of the book?
Or if you have a really juicy anecdote about what somebody did, someone's going to write about it on the internet. And it's possible that person will see that anecdote, not even see that you've hidden it back by putting it on a high schooler or something much further away. I think it's easier to discover these things. And also, reacting on social media, I think that ship has sailed. I don't think you can cow a person to not coming forward because it would embarrass them. Because those individuals that are going to come forward really don't care.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, pretty much the entirety of social media is one big cringe fest.
Yes.
One of the things that protects me while I'm writing my memoir is that 95% of the characters in it are dead. And dead people cannot sue you for libel. You cannot defame a memory of a person and get sued for it by somebody else. So There's that. So if you, dear listener, are worried that your composite characters or your characters in your book are based on real people, but they're all dead, you get a free pass.
Yes. And now I think we can talk about, what do we think of the book overall?
You didn't want to talk about the poem.
Oh, there's a poem. You want to do the poem?
We don't have to read it, but it's a great poem. It's one of my favorite poets. I found her early on when I was an undergraduate named Sharon Olds, and she wrote a book called The Father. It spoke to me in like the most visceral way possible because her father was dying and she was descriptive and unapologetic, and she just described the mucus from his lung cancer going into a cup he would spit into, and she would just dedicate an entire poem to that. And I went, you can do that? Because my father was like that too. He was literally falling apart, and he didn't care. And he did it all to himself mostly, and it was disgusting. And she pretty much gave me permission to write about my dad's amputated toes and various other ailments. So thank you, Sharon Olds. Anyway,
I think I know who our bio for this website on the website page is going to be this time.
Definitely Sharon Olds. So Lamont puts a poem in here, and I've actually taught this poem too. It's a very classic poem to teach in creative writing classes. The point, she says, Lamont, for bringing in this poem by Sharon Olds is it's about trying to find some meaning in the suffering, which is another reason why one writes. And I would argue that's the main reason, not so much revenge, but the main reason I'm writing my memoir is there's got to be a use for this crap. Like, why are you carrying around all this trauma? It's got to be good for something. And so Sharon Olds writes this poem, very famous, called I Go Back to May 1937. It is fantastic. I teach it in the beginning when I teach poetry because of the details. I go, okay, underline every specific detail in the poem, and then stand back and tell me what it's about and like what feelings you had. Like, it's such an emotional poem.
I'll put a link to it in the webpage, but basically, what is the poem about?
The poem is about a speaker whose parents were not good to their children, and she is the child. And she picks up a picture of them being happy, and this is right before they got together. And she looks at them and is like, I wish you two never got together. And then she realizes, wait, no, as crappy as you were, I want to exist. And that's pretty much the gist. Unfortunately, it does not do the poem justice at all. But there's a few lines in here, and one of them I remember distinctly, and I remember it often. You are going to do bad things to children. I read this poem years ago in an undergraduate class, and I will always remember that line. And I remember that line when I'm writing often, like, you are going to do bad things to children. It's so simple. It's a great poem. Please, listener, go read it. You can get it for free online. Go to, like, Poetry Foundation. Sharon Olds is the shit. And one last thing, though. Her son did take her to court. And she is not allowed to write poems about him anymore.
Okay.
So I wouldn't say she got sued for libel, but pretty damn close.
Yep.
So it can happen.
So let's talk about the book as a whole. What do you think? Would you recommend it? What are your favorite parts? All that stuff. Basically, the cliff notes for people that haven't listened to the past half a year of our podcasts and just wants to know about this Bird by Bird book.
I don't know why it's so popular. Why is it so popular?
I think there are certain books that gain a level of popularity so that when people are searching for a particular style book, they find that book. And this book is for a particular type of writer that would have taken a class but wants to write or can't manage to get this book out of their head. And people say, oh, this book, Bird by Bird, really helped me. And they pick it up and say, oh, this really helped me. And there may be a dozen or more books that have been written since Bird by Bird that do the exact same thing. But this is the one that shows up at the top of the search bar.
This one probably pays for her house.
Mine is the 25th anniversary edition. Wow. So when the publisher decides after 25 years to reissue it, that's big. Because nobody's reissued Bickham's Scene and Structure.
No, they have not. No one has reissued Gardner.
I think they do reissue Gardner.
No, they don't. There's no 30-year anniversary.
I had a more recent publication version.
Did you?
Yeah.
All right. Well, it was pretty bad. I would say part one is pretty indispensable. Like, if I was teaching a class, I wouldn't want to assign the whole book. Mm-hmm. But part one was really good.
So you have assigned reading for shitty first drafts. That one shows up in a lot of things. Would you say that's the best single chapter of what she has for writing? Or do you think there's some other ones that are better?
It's very famous, and I'm sure it helps most people. But I don't know if that's necessarily the one that was most valuable to me. I think the picture frame one was very practical.
Oh, the picture frame being the
writing assignments.
Writing a certain amount within a...
Yeah, that one was really good. I'm trying to think. What was the activities that we've done? The letter.
The letter was useful, but that's not something from the book. I think our activities...
Oh, that's right. We had to make that up. Anyway, what about you? What was your favorite chapter?
The first five chapters of the book, the short assignment, shitty first draft, and perfectionism, I guess those three were really, really useful. Because those are like how to get yourself physically writing and what mental tricks you can do to keep yourself going and kind of the mentality you need to be a writer if you're writing every day. And the other part was the radio station KFKD.
K-fucked?
Yeah. And the jealousy one. I mean, I think those were emotionally very gratifying to read.
Yeah, I really liked those. Oh, I would say the number one most helpful in terms of like practical advice was plot treatment.
Oh, yeah, plot treatment was a good one.
But emotional support... Radio station, K-fucked, and jealousy. She nailed it with jealousy.
Yeah.
That was probably one of the most poignant essays in the whole book.
And writer's block was a pretty good one, too. If you'd never actually considered that kind of situation, I'd recommend this for two different types of people. Number one, I'd recommend it for somebody that just really wanted to write and just was having no luck at it all. Like, just basically, they told me they wanted to write, and then they'd tell me the next time I met that, you know, it just isn't happening. I'm just not able to do it. This is a really good hand-holding approach to someone that's just beginning writing. Because while I didn't necessarily find the plot and the dialogue in those chapters very useful for me, I think if someone had never actually encountered them in a class before, they'd be great. And then the second type of person I recommend it for is somebody that is like actively working on writing, but just feels that they're not able to do it because they just can't seem to get the words out. They can't seem to do the simple thing that all these other writers do all the time and get words out and be able to come to their writing and not hate it. And all those like little mind tricks you need to write. And this definitely has that in the select set of chapters.
Right.
Like you almost need a second one, which was just like just the bird. And that would be
just the bird.
And that would just be like the highlight sections, like just what a writer needs like to have on their table that you have to come put your butt in the chair in the morning. What are you going to grab to help you inspire?
Right.
And the picture frame method is such a good mentality.
Yeah. You know, it would be a good idea, dear listener, if you bought this book, skim through it. Part one, read part one. If you're going to read it, read it. You know, go through Radio Station K-Fucked, go through Jealousy, but highlight the ones that speak specifically to you. Like, highlight in the table of contents. And like what Kim was saying is when you find, like, a block and you're like, oh, God, I can't move on, you pick up the book, you look at the table of contents, and you read the titles, and you go, oh, perfectionism, I need to read that right now. You know, or... oh, plot treatment. Yeah, I'm really lost. I need to read that right now. Like, you know, oh, God, my friend just got published and I'm so freaking jealous. Jealousy, right? A lot of these chapters, some of them, you're just going to be like, why are they in here? I mean, you know why they're in there, but there's a lot of fluff.
One could also say that given that some of these chapters speak so clearly to us, it's possible that some of those other chapters will speak very clearly to a different writer.
That's true. You know, a lot of the stories and stuff she tells, I find myself doing this in my classroom. Like, I would tell stories like this in class because you're trying to connect with people. And, you know, in a classroom setting, just giving them a bunch of facts doesn't do it.
No, they won't remember that. They'll remember the anecdote. And if it's an anecdote that actually speaks to them, they'll really remember it. And if it's an anecdote that doesn't speak to them, like, oh, yeah, that time that she spent the whole class talking about her dog.
Right. But when you can make people emotionally attached to something, it's not always just remembering it, it's understanding it. And I can see that that's what she was trying to do in this book. Sometimes it didn't quite work out, and maybe it just didn't translate well outside of the classroom.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking about a book written in 1994, too. So
I don't know. I don't think that matters.
Eh, some of the stuff was a little bit dated.
Yes, the radio station. I mean, what kids don't listen to the radio anymore, do they?
Polaroids.
Polaroids. If a friend came up to you, oh, Kim, I hear you're a writer and you finished a novel. I've been thinking about writing. Would you, when Christmas came around, would you gift them this book?
I don't think I would do it just because someone said they were writing a novel. But I definitely think if I had a friend that was struggling, maybe I would gift it. Mostly I would just tell them about it. I'm really bad at giving out gifts for Christmas.
I think people should not be good at gift giving during Christmas because it is a corporate holiday. Anyway. All right. Well, that is that. Goodbye, Anne Lamott.
And now for something completely different. The reason why we didn't actually tell you what book we're going to read next, we were still figuring it out. But after some thoughts, after looking at a lot of different books, after
a few phone calls
to various people, we decided that it was time to try a memoir writing book.
Dun, dun. Memoir genre for the win.
Because right now, Renee is writing her memoir. If she's ever going to be on top of a book about memoir writing, it would be now. Because hopefully in another 6 months, you'll be done with it. And then you can write your science fiction story.
Yep. I just want to be done with it. And also, I think a lot of our listeners are memoir writers. Or some of people who would be our listeners are memoir writers. And, you know, if you're a fiction writer, don't run away. There is lots in there for fiction writers. In fact, you can mine your childhood, like Lamott says, with a lot of the strategies that the book we pick has. Yep.
And what is the book?
It's not here. I'll be right back.
Damn it.
But writing the memoir. Subtitle.
Just so you know, I'm leaving that one in.
Okay. I'm back, and I have the book now. I went downstairs, Kim's living room, kitchen.
Got it.
Okay. The book is called Writing the Memoir, A Practical Guide to the Craft, the Personal Challenges, and Ethical Dilemmas of Writing Your True Stories.
We decided we'd go with more technical for this one, nuts and bolts of how to write a memoir.
Yes. Well, it's like how we toggle, right? We toggle between a process book and then a prescriptive writing advice book.
Because by the time we get done with the process book, we want some hard facts and how-to prescriptive stuff. And by the time we get to reading a book where someone's telling us what to do, we're like, let's just open our minds to possibilities.
Yes. We have a good pattern.
It's not a bad strategy. If you yourself want to spend time reading lots of craft books, it helps.
Yeah. Back and forth. So the author is named Judith Barrington. And she's written one memoir and like six poetry books.
Okay.
Which is great because I'm more of a poet, or at least I was. So this will be very helpful. This book was also published in the 90s.
Another one in the 90s?
I believe so. Well, this one says, no, this says Portland, Oregon, 2002.
Ah.
Wait. Copyright 1997.
So, still not in this current century, but, you know, we looked at a lot of books. We read the first chapter of this one online. We decided this was it. But also, to kind of talk about why we'd want to tackle a book on how to write memoir and to figure out like what it is about being taught to write a memoir, we are going to interview one of Renee's favorite memoir teachers.
My name is Jocelyn Linder, and I am a writing instructor and an author. I have written a number of books in several genres. I have written business books and I have written humor books. And then most recently, I wrote a memoir called The Family Gene, came out with HarperCollins. Let's see, I've written personal essays in the New York Times, and I've for a long time wrote for the New York Post. So I feel like I have experienced the gamut of what you can do as a professional writer in this life. So far.
And the class that you teach?
And I teach memoir currently for the Book Incubator as well as Gotham Writers Workshop.
How many years have you taught memoir?
7 years. I've been teaching for 7 years.
Based on your classes, why do people want to write their memoirs?
I mean, personally, I think writing memoir can accomplish a number of things. I think there's a huge amount of healing that can happen when you write down your pain or you try to organize your life into a narrative. There's something about it that's tremendously healing. It almost feels like it offers you a way to see a lot of experience with a purpose. It kind of gives it maybe a different angle, a different filter through which to see it. Sometimes it's pain, sometimes it's joy, you know, whatever it is. It gives you a way to sort of perceive your life, which I think is really appealing to people. I think some people write memoir because they're looking for connection. They're trying to tell a story that they think will help other people, maybe going through something they've gone through, or they're seeking community. So they're trying to put their story out to find people that maybe can relate and relate to them in a specific way.
Why did you take the memoir writing class, Renee?
Because I don't know everything. No, I need deadlines. And if I don't have deadlines, it normally doesn't matter to me enough to get my work done. And knowing that there is not just other people on the other end that are going to read it, because then you get a little bit of a thrill, like, oh, good, I'm going to write this and see if I get that reaction back that I want, or they see things that I don't see. But I also love having a teacher there, someone who like really they know what they're doing, and they're also controlling everybody. Sometimes they can get a little unruly.
Yeah. No, I love that. That's also a great point. Like, I think classes, people who take memoir classes or even any sort of writing class, they're seeking the accountability. They're looking for an audience, right? It's an early way into an audience, you know, and sometimes people just want to write. So you ask the question, why do people write memoir? I think sometimes people just want to write. They just want to tell a story and they maybe don't know what to make up. So they're like, I will just mine my own experiences and tell those stories.
The most common question that authors are asked, fiction authors ask, are where to get your ideas? And when you're writing memoir, that's not a problem.
Right. Exactly. You have this life of experience. And I often say, like, our lives are infinite, right? Because you could really luxuriate in any one 60-minute period. You can say, I will write about the first hour of kindergarten and just minute by minute, right? Tell that story, break it apart.
So, given that people have their own life experience, given that you can choose whatever part of your life you want to write for your memoir from, what causes people to struggle when they're writing their memoirs?
You know, the problems people encounter with writing anything, they're all quite similar, right? So there's what Renee was mentioning before about accountability. You know, sometimes it's just really hard to write. You know, it's hard to sit down and make yourself write. I often liken it to going to the gym. It's like a great idea to go, but like nobody ever wants to. And also in the moment, there's like a thousand other things I could be doing rather than sitting down and writing a story. So I think that that's probably problem number one for everybody. And then I think there's memory. How do I remember things? What about things that are required for the story? But all I remember is like that my mother yelled at me, but I can't even remember what she was yelling at me about. But she yelled at me, made me run away, which is like the inciting action of my book. And I need to mention that she yelled at me. What do I do with an incomplete memory? Like things like that, I think can be hugely problematic for memoir writers.
How about you, Renee? Do you want to add anything? Problems you've had running your memoir? Oh my goodness. I feel like I never know what I'm doing, and what I do choose to do is wrong. It's horrible. But that's another reason why, like, taking your class is so helpful, because you get other people to read it, and you get somebody who's written a book and succeeded in that, and they can look at your work and be like, hey, I can see this issue, or I can see this thing. Try this. And then that cut out like a year of self-loathing and sadness.
Can I talk about your memoir? Can I speak specifically to your memoir?
You remember it? Sure.
Remember it. I remember like pieces of it. You used pictures, right? Like the photographs. Was it a photo album or was it just random pictures that were sort of launching the stories? Or was it?
They were random pictures that I'd found in a box.
Right. You're going through pictures and then flashing back into these memories, right?
Yeah.
So one of the things I remember thinking with your book, and that you do it very well, like you're a good writer, you can sort of get away with this. But one of the things I often caution people about is like writing about finding a box of pictures is a little dicey when you're thinking about entertainment and narrative. If you're trying to entertain people, like what's so exciting about finding a box of pictures? Like nothing. Whereas like the memory sparked by it is actually often quite fascinating, right? So I will say like you did it really well. So you like almost like ruined this idea. But I do think like people will write like page after page about like a therapy session where they had a giant breakthrough. But the fact of the matter is, I think therapy is boring when it's me talking, right? So when I'm in somebody else's therapy session in a book that I'm not even in the therapy, I'm just like reading it, that's dicey. So maybe what matters is the epiphany, right? Maybe if you go back and tell me a story and then just go, and then in therapy, bam. What matters more is like all the things that made that epiphany, right? So all the things that make you pick up the picture and go and have the memory, right? So that's what actually matters. That's where the drama of the story is. So I think people sometimes make the mistake. And so in your case, it was a device that is successful. You end up using the pictures to launch back. It's almost like a transitional point. And in the moment of finding the pictures, I think you managed to, correct me if I'm wrong, there's like people drinking, there's like friends coming in that present, there's like stuff going on. There's like your brother.
Yeah, my brother makes appearances and says funny things. I turn up the humor a lot, or like dark humor a lot. Yeah, I try to avoid like the here and now so much, just like what is significant about these pictures. I believe the pictures that I found came from, I was writing about how my grandmother had died. And she was a hoarder, and I had to climb through a big pile of clothing, like literally climb like Mount Everest in a closet to get clothing to bury her in. And all of it was from Goodwill. And I'm like, I'm gonna bury my grandmother in Goodwill clothing. And at the same time, I imagined her ghost there yelling at me. And then I went and I found pictures randomly in a drawer, and I just grabbed the drawer and ran out of the house. Like, I kind of freaked out. So I think that was high energy and high fun for a reader. So I think maybe that's why it worked, as opposed to just,
let's go organize a box now.
Yeah, I wasn't like organizing a box.
Yeah, you can either use it as a device where it can be really successful. You've managed to build out a world, and that's how you make it matter. But I caution everybody, if you're like, but like therapy was amazing, nobody wants to hear your dream, consider how do you tell that story of that epiphany without the therapy session? Like, how can you get us there in a way that we can be in the therapy and go, okay, now I care. I don't know. Sorry. I kind of jumped ahead.
No, that's great.
That was one of the questions I'm going to ask you, was how do you help people in the class overcome these struggles they have? And that's a really great example. Do you have any other examples of things that you do in your class? Some people have problems and you have an approach that you always take.
You know, it's so, again, we go back to this idea of our lives are infinite, right? My metaphor that I'm obsessed with, that I use all the time, and so Renee has probably heard it, is our lives are like a forest, right? So it's like you can name all the things in a forest, but it's going to get kind of boring. Whereas if you carve out a path, you point, right? So like this ant, this bark, this canopy of trees, this river, right? Like you're specific in like what you want the reader, you're the director. So you tell the reader where to look. And one of my favorite realizations, did you, either of you read Joan Didion's A Year of Magical Thinking?
Yes. I love Joan Didion.
Tell us what that book is about. This is a lesson from my class.
I think it was about her husband dying and her trying to kind of find herself again and deal with grief.
Yeah, it's her grief story after her husband dies. But something else happened to Joan Didion in that year that she just leaves out of that book. Do you know what it is?
I don't remember.
Did her daughter die too?
That's the second book.
She have an affair.
She didn't have an affair because her husband was gone, but she did date, fall in love, and remarry within the year of Magical Thinking.
Wow.
wow.
Yeah. Everybody's reaction is that.
For our listeners, my mouth just kind of dropped open.
It is shocking, I think, for people who don't know that. But I think that part of our jobs as authors and as writers is to curate what we need to tell people. In my opinion, I really do think it's okay that she didn't tell us. She didn't lie. She didn't say, I could never remarry or I'll never fall in love again. That was not a theme in her book. Her book was about the grief over the loss of her husband, which I believe was real and true. And just because this other thing happened, I think for the purposes of the book she was trying to write, it would have really complicated and it even maybe compromised the book she was writing. So by leaving it out, by saying that's not a thing I'm even going to touch, the reader doesn't care. The reader's not going to know that that happened. Maybe they will if they listen to a podcast 3 years after you've passed away. Like then, okay, fine, then they know. But it's like for the most part, people don't ask questions of things that you don't tell them. If you go, then I met this guy and started dating him, but forget about that because that's not part of this story. I'll tell you the only thing anyone wants you to then talk about is that.
Yeah. I've actually been tempted to take my brother out of the story.
Yeah.
Though people wouldn't even realize I had a brother.
And it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
If it doesn't matter to that narrative, why keep him in there? Unless he's offering something or fulfilling something in the story.
I love how, on the one hand, there's the perception of memoir, well, like you're just writing down what happened to you. And, you know, obviously someone can just write, but it's obvious that when you delve into it and you really work on it, is that there's a lot of technique that goes into it, which is why we are doing this book. It's the it's writing the memoir by Judith Barrington. It's from the 90s. It might be a little obscure now, but I'm just kind of wondering if you'd read it.
No, I haven't. Do you recommend it?
We'll know in the podcast. So the other one I had when I was writing up my questions, you talked about therapy, and I always tell Renee I'm going to get her T-shirt that says, you know, memoir is cheaper than therapy. In your opinion, would you say that's true?
This is actually something that I struggle with as a teacher. Sometimes there are people that come to my classes like in active crisis. Like there was a woman in one class that her husband, I was so confused about when he died because she kept saying 2 weeks ago and then it was 2 weeks ago. And I was like, oh, like this is a whole different thing that's happening right here. And there's a wonderful phrase that I often repeat, which is, it's helpful to write from the scar and not the wound, right? It's helpful when you have an objectivity, especially with things like rage and grief. It's just cloudy. Your perception of things is a little bit clouded. Like the person you're trying to write about is either going to be sort of like vilified or what's the opposite? Angelized. It's really hard to get a clear human sense of the person because you're so sort of broken or injured in that moment. You're so hurting in that moment. So I often have to remind people, like, this is not therapy. We are not each other's therapists. And when we're critiquing, it is a little bit of a different muscle because I think that how you critique in like a fiction class, you know, you can kind of be like, oh, this is really working and this needs some work. But people in a memoir class will be like, this is working, but your dad's a real asshole or, you know, whatever. And you have to kind of stop them. You have to stop the music for a second. And even if the person has written a character that is their father that is not favorable, you do not get to say that ever, right? Like in human existence, we don't say that to each other, even if it's true. Our close friends find ways to sort of say it that are loving. So critiques can be a little more challenging in that way where I have to police the language people use. I often have to remind everyone, we think of them as characters. So if the father is coming off a certain way and you think they need some humanizing, you can say like your dad's coming off, he seems like really aggressive, really mean. I think you have to do a little more work to stay polite and also kind because it is people's lives and you don't want to say something that's not necessarily helpful and is actually quite hurtful.
That is advanced critiquing then. You have to have some tact. I don't always have tact. So I'm not very good at tact. I tend to always overly do the positive so that I don't end up hurting them because I'm assuming someone else has better tech than I do. And as long as somebody else says the critique, I always figure that's better if I try to do it myself. And if no one says it, then I'll come out and be like, all right, I'll try to say the critique. because I feel it's important and this person can gain from it. And hopefully it doesn't come out bad because I just, my social skills aren't the best. That's how I tend to do it. And one other trick, and I think you used this one too, instead of saying you as the author, oh, you did this in the story and you did this, you say the protagonist.
Mm.
The protagonist did this, the protagonist did that, even though we all know who the I is, you know, sometimes that's helpful.
I like that too. I'm a little more lax about that. You know, everyone's in these memoir classes, but what I will say to what you just said is that, so I'm a really selfish person and most of the things I do in life are for me. And so if I'm going to waste my time, like reading somebody's work that they're going to ignore my critique, which the surest way to get someone to ignore your critique is to start with, I don't get it, or this is kind of boring, or I don't really like this part, right? Like immediately that person has either decided in that moment never to work on that thing again. So you're all your effort out the window, or they are shutting down because you clearly don't get them. Like you don't understand their work. So they're not going to listen to anything else you say. So I have therefore just wasted my time reading, coming up with ideas of great things to tell them and whatever. Whereas what you just said, when you're overly effusive or even just kind and like immediately finding the things about it that you related to and liked, I think of it as like building a bridge. I have now built a bridge with the person. And now when I give them the critique, when I say the thing to elevate or to make it better, they're going to hear me. They're going to be like, oh, this person gets me. And now the other thing, they were like, you know, oh, you know, if you gave me more information about your dad, I could really understand him better. It always cracks me up. You know how when you're a teacher, they can grade you at the end of a class?
Yes, yes. Your evaluations. I know them well.
There's no other career where people are like, at the end of your job, they're like, this is what I think of you for realsies with anonymity.
Yeah. Oh my God. No wonder it's stressful being a teacher.
I'm really lucky and I mostly get good reviews, but when I've gotten bad ones, they're almost always the same. And they say, she's too positive. She doesn't give me any feedback. And I always am like, if you go back and look, I tore you apart. Like I usually also know who it is because I've just been teaching writing to people and they write.
You know their voice. Yeah.
I know exactly who you are. But anyway, I usually am thinking like, I tore you apart. You just didn't know how to read it. Like you didn't even see it, which is great. Like I'm happy. And I hope that makes them continue to write because my objective in these classes is to get them to write, right? I'm not the New York Times. I'm a teacher. I just need them to keep writing and get better and better and better the more they write.
This was a really great interview. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Absolutely.
That was great. Can you remind people one more time where you teach? Because now I'm like excited again. I'm like, oh, I should go back to your class.
Teaching right now for the book incubator. And then I'm teaching for Gotham. And I also have my own. I do my own on the side classes.
Oh, cool. Is that like on your website?
It will be.
When you do get the website going with your classes, and then you just let us know. I'll go back into the episodes and link it in there.
Awesome. Thanks, Deb.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad you did this. Thank you.
Good luck.
Bye.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
Oh, wait. Shit. I just revealed how old I am.
I'll cut that out.
Okay, good.